Blog Talk Radio.
Mojuba Akoda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun, to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun, to all those that are listening. Who are tuned in, we give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe, welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, and New Power Radio Network. You can find us on Facebook as a like and group page. Myself is Queen Tahira, New Power Radio Network, and, of course, Sign of the Times. We also ask that you please support our sponsor, Standard Raising Culture, headed up by my co-host tonight, Dr. James Jones. Find him on Facebook as James Jones, as well as a like and group page for Manhood Raising Culture, and on the World Wide Web at manhoodraiseculture.com. Also, please support Unity Design, Arlene Gordon out of Detroit, Please look him up on Facebook as Arlie Gordon and on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com. And Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E. Also, please never forget our brothers and sisters who are behind enemy lines. Please support Unheard Voices, Free Alabama Movement, and Free Ohio Movement on Facebook, respectively, as well as the World Wide Web at freealabamamovement.com and freeohiomovement.org. If you're curious how to send a contribution to Sign of the Times in order to help keep us on the air and be able to expand opportunities to come to your city, you can do that two ways. You can do it via PayPal and our email address at signothetimes19@gmail.com. Signothetimes19@gmail.com. You also can U.S. Postal mail us a contribution. And our mailing address is 1623 Dalton Street, D-A-L-T-O-N, Street, number 14939, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45250. Again, our mailing address is 1623 Dalton Street, D-A-L-T-O-N, number 14939, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45250. And, of course, you can give us a call, 330-366-6838, and we'd love to hear from you. So tonight I'm going to go ahead and open up my co-host, Mike. Peace, Dr. Jones. How are you doing this evening?
I'm great, Queen. I'm great. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay. All right. I'm great. I am great.
Good, good. How's school?
School is school. You know, it's work. It's that magical time of the year where we are getting ready to wind up the semester and go home, basically. And it's the moment where students begin to want to meet with you, and they want to talk about their grade. So, yeah, that's where I'm at. I actually had a very interesting invite that I did earlier today, which was working with addressing a group of eighth graders who are part of the 100 Collegiate, a mentorship program that some of my students are involved in. So I had a chance to interact with some of the young folk today and came away very, very, very impressed. Very impressed.
Good. Well, that's good news, because I know sometimes we get bombarded with the images that we see, especially in the media, and so it's good to hear that that was a positive experience.
Yeah, you know, working with our young people, you know, I've learned that each and every moment that we can seize as a really positive one is one that we definitely need to seize, because quite simply they are often too far and few in between. So I definitely embrace it, and, you know, I celebrate those young folk I dealt with earlier today. They were definitely a breath of fresh air, so to speak.
I say. Well, I know that I shared on Manhood Raising Culture Facebook page, and we invite the listeners to please, you know, again, check out the group and like page for Manhood Raising Culture, a video of our young black men. So I yield to you for introduction of tonight's topic.
Okay. Tonight we are, you know, we're basing our discussion around the video that was shown. I want to say it was Alcorn State University, and it was in many ways a brawl that occurred amongst African-American males in the dining hall of Alcorn State University. And, you know, many people, I think, would feign being shocked about it, but to be absolutely honest with you, I was neither shocked nor amused, and have actually seen that type of behavior from our collegians actually on several occasions. As, you know, as much as I would like to say it was a rare thing to see, but nah, it's almost par for the course when you're talking about certain segments of African-American males that are on collegiate campuses. There seems to be, and I always talk about this story. I was working in a record store, Coconuts Record and Music, in Columbus, Ohio, and a woman came in with her daughter, and she complimented me on my tie, the mother did, and as I'm saying, you know, thank you, she said, did your girlfriend buy it for you? And she was trying to introduce her daughter to me, and her daughter walked out the store because she was embarrassed. And the lady, she stands there for a moment, and she says, you know, see, I can tell that you're a college boy. It's written all over you. And I tell my students now that being on a collegiate campus, oftentimes it is very difficult, if not impossible, to tell the difference between what many people would refer to as a thug or the hood persona and our male collegiate students. And also, there used to be a cavernous difference between the streetwalker and the college girl. Now, in many ways, those two are indistinguishable from one another. So in many ways, I guess what we're talking about is tonight we're going to talk about African-American males, but all in all, we are reflecting upon the idea of the influences that are going on in regards to the construction of manhood and the personas that African-American males on college campuses are exhibiting. So let's go ahead, Queen, and just jump into it. And I'll read a piece that actually is about almost 3 years old now that kind of is applicable to what we're talking about. And in many ways, it's shocking that it is as applicable as it was when I first wrote it. So I'll jump right into it. It's titled Thug University, Reflections on African-American Males' New Millennium Educational Priorities. And it appears on my site, manhoodraceculture.com. And here's the piece right here. One of the more peculiar inside jokes shared among those raised in, quote unquote, the hood, meaning lower middle class, working class, and poor African-American neighborhoods, occurs when someone has been arrested, tried, convicted, and sentenced to prison. It is at this moment that others affectionately relate that he or she is on his way to college, albeit not to pursue a traditional liberal arts degree, rather a BA in criminality, or possibly a MS in robbery. All agree that the convicted will return from college a slicker confidence man or bolder burglar. Many of my peers choose such an educational path. Fortunately, innumerable career paths and opportunities, including initiatives to save African-American males, offer realistic alternatives to incarceration. The alluded-to initiatives serve as a constant reminder of the national crisis facing African-American males. Personally, such initiatives facilitated a host of firsts for me. My first collegiate visit, my first academic conference, and a similar program, the Summer Research Opportunity Program, SROP, paved the way for graduate school. Such outreach programs made the mentorship I received from Dr. James N. Upton during my undergraduate tenure and Dr. Paulette Pierce as I pursued my initial master's degree at The Ohio State University all the more important. The aforementioned mentorship was critical to my academic success as I learned how to be inside of collegiate classrooms, academic conferences, workshops, and symposiums. Consequently, my current station as a tenured professor is a bit surreal. I am now on the other side of the desk and charged with mentoring the next generation of African Americans. Unfortunately, I'm finding that this process, particularly in regards to African American males, is increasingly difficult. Put simply, this latest generation of black males does not appear to be particularly interested in academics, politics, or intellectual thought. In fact, I have watched as many of my current students have done their best to transform institutions of higher learning into an entity best termed Thug University. The stages I lecture upon on a daily basis have provided a clear view of the drastically altered demeanor, preparation, goal structure, and behavior of many African American males. From my perspective, the driving force behind this transformation is a flawed understanding of black manhood. As previously mentioned, I participated in several initiatives aimed at saving the endangered black male. Such programs operated out of the belief that there was a desperate need to provide, and I quote, historically marginalized minority populations, end quote, access to higher education. According to those fighting on our behalf, the most significant obstacle preventing our inclusion into said higher education institutions was institutional racism, meaning that institutions of higher learning operated in a manner that individuals such as me, a first-generation collegian, would never gain access. I'm certain that those battling for our inclusion during the 80s considered their foe, institutional racism, unconquerable. They never imagined that a decade later, a more menacing enemy would arrive, an enemy that makes institutional racism appear juvenile. The latest opponent in the battle to save African-American males is a siren that has mesmerized black males. This enemy is best termed thug culture, a lifestyle propagated and delivered to our young men by contemporary rap stars. For a significant population of black male collegians, rap icons such as Rick Ross, YG, and Young Jeezy hold more sway over their values, aspirations, and worldview than Du Bois, Baldwin, Hughes, King, X, Newton, or Obama could ever hope to. Mentors of today's African-American males are in for a rude awakening if they believe that mere exposure to collegiate campuses is enough to repel the omnipresent, seemingly omnipotent influence of today's rap artists on the values and goal structures of African-American males. Such an assertion pains me, as rap music is dear to my heart. In fact, I was politicized by 80s rap music. My mind was significantly impacted by Public Enemy's It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, Boogie Down Productions' Edutainment, Brand Nubian's One for All, X-Clan's To the East Blackwards, and Paris's The Devil Made Me Do It. However, the youth culture I was steeped in was not only politically progressive, but also created by African Americans to serve black interests. Unfortunately, the days of yesteryear are long gone. Things have turned so sour within some urban enclaves that African Americans have begun to fear their own. The notorious B.I.G. stated as much in his tour de force, Things Then Changed. And I quote, "Back in the days, our parents used to take care of us. Look at them now. They're even fucking scared of us," end quote. Why should previous generations of African Americans not be concerned about this latest expression of manhood, considering its proclivity for drug abuse, alcoholism, misogyny, profanity, immorality, and antisocial behavior? All characteristics, I might add, that are foreign to the way that persons of African descent have historically lived. African-American male collegians who are in the throes of a nihilistic, homoerotic thug culture fail to realize that they are an aberration to historic manifestations of black manhood. Their entire existence contradicts the esteemed traditions of honorable, smooth, articulate, educated, well-dressed brothers who occupied leadership positions in their public and private lives. Today, the smooth, suave, and debonair African-American man has been replaced by young men whose lack of style, and trust me, style is not achieved by one foolishly purchasing overpriced, gaudy European clothing, is rivaled only by their inability to articulate a coherent thought. Surrounding African-American collegians' desperation to be included in thug culture is an often ignored query of what is the payoff for relinquishing long-standing African-American cultural traditions in favor of niggardly behavior. Apparently, the payoff for African-American collegians is the opportunity to earn street credibility among common street hoodlums whom they desperately seek to emulate. If nothing else, I wish that the young men I view from the stage realize that they are the best that our race has to offer, and they're allowing the streets to significantly influence their cultural values and goal structures makes as much sense as a tail wagging a dog. Young collegiate brothers, you are supposed to be the head and not the tail in regards to setting the values, priorities, goals, and future direction of our community. Hence, you are now center stage. The spotlight is shining on you, and we are eagerly awaiting to see if you will assume your rightful position as the next generation of educated race men. Or will you prove cowardly and continue down a path of aberrant behavior that none of those who came before you would either recognize or celebrate? And that's the piece right there, Queen. I yield.
Ashe, Dr. Jones, thank you so much for that. Now, what I hope to accomplish tonight during our conversation is that we look at the not only the whys of this, but the how of this. And so what I would like to do is ask you, in the years that you have been teaching, even when you were, you can compare that to when you were in school, how much do you think the relationship dynamics that our young men have, both with their fathers and with their mothers, have to do with some of the behavior that we're seeing displayed publicly right now?
You know, one of the things that I can say about my era was quite simply, we were not inundated. I don't believe necessarily that the exposure and the socialization patterns of Black boys with their mothers and their fathers has changed appreciably. But I believe that the influence and the introduction of the tidal wave of cultural images, music, video, movies, everything that you can imagine has become so intense and so powerful that it has in many ways, if not overtaken, the lessons and socialization that parents are offering, grandparents are offering, other siblings or family members, or even non-related mentors. I think that the internet and all of this constant drove of quote-unquote misinformation of how to be has in many ways toppled many of the things that our children should have learned or have learned at home and have almost conveniently chosen to ignore as they go through their day-to-day lives. But I don't buy into what I consider a straw man argument surrounding African-American fathers are now any less involved in their children's lives than they were before. We've always had that element within our community. But I think that for many of those individuals where they would have probably latched on to a friend or a friend's father or an uncle or a family friend, that these new images and personas of manhood have been introduced by technology, unfortunately.
So, just from what I've observed in my time period, and I'm certainly not speaking as a man, but as a sister and a daughter and a mother of a son, I see a big difference in some of the conversations even that I've had with men who are, say, 50 and older versus conversations that we have with those between 30 and 40 and the conversations we have between the 20 and 30 and so on. With every 10 years, with every decade, there's like a different type of image of what being a strong Black man is. And at one point, our young men were dressed a certain way. I mean, I know I remember hearing my friends speak on wearing tailor-made pants, and that was the big thing. You know, if you had tailor-made pants and you wanted to go somewhere nice, you know, that's what you were expected to wear. But what we see now is these images of skinny leg jeans, even skirts on some of our brothers, especially when it comes to those who call themselves a part of the hip-hop genre. They've completely transformed the image of a Black male, let alone the image of a strong Black male. And I'm not sure if I were to say, you know, if I were asked right now in 2017 to describe what a strong Black man is and looks like, I have an image in my mind. But could I say I actually know many of them? No. You know, it's not as prevalent in the community as I definitely remember it to be. I remember having strong uncles. I remember having influence from my grandfather and my father. I remember those things, and it just doesn't seem that the I don't know if it's the lack of commitment or obligation or what, but it just doesn't seem to be as prevalent as it once was, and I yield.
Yeah, but I don't think that we're saying two different things. What you're saying, I recognize that as valid parts of our experience and our contemporary existence. I think that the fathers that we remember from our generation and what have you, that today, many of those fathers, because let's be honest, that residentially we're dealing with what could best be termed geographically a disassembled community, and we need to, as a community, actually have a discussion about, is it possible that which one is more influential and matters more, the neighborhood, meaning the residential area that we live in, or the community that we live in, which allows you to live wherever you want to and still be able to be considered a part of that enclave. But I think that many of those individuals that were the staples of our community are not living within the neighborhood, so to speak, anymore. However, but many of those individuals, I can tell you from just even my own experience, our hearts are still there, number one. And we're always seeking opportunities to go ahead and be involved in any movement, any uplift movement, any community organization within those communities. But I think that father, that strong image, is number one away, and number two, more than likely, in a professional job, a professional setting, he's working. To be absolutely honest with you, locked away somewhere. You know, you like myself. You know that if you call me, more than likely you're not going to get me on the phone because I'm usually off writing. If I'm not teaching that day, I'm writing and researching and doing what I have to do, what I desire to do with my life. So it doesn't mean that I'm not going to get back with you, but I'm not physically, I guess you could say, available in the neighborhoods and what have you. The thing about hip hop, I discount hip hop totally as being an illustrator and orchestrator of anything dealing with a productive, non-toxic manhood image. You're correct when you say that, you know, they're wearing skirts, if not dresses. Young Thug, Jeffrey, put on a damn dress on his album cover. And for our generation, that's morally repugnant. But those are the images that so many of our children who are searching for manhood images are consuming. And that's a real viable issue, if not, can we use the term threat to the existence of African-American men? So I agree with you somewhat when you're saying that there are fewer of us, but we're still out here. You know, we're still out here, but it's heavy lifting and it's a lot of work. It is literally work for us. And, you know, I can speak for myself, as I said earlier, that the children, the eighth graders that I talked to earlier, that meant the world to me. You know, being provided those opportunities to interact with our own is, in a word, priceless. And I yield with that claim.
Ashe. And so, considering the fact that it takes a lot to get our children even out of high school, because we know that, you know, the school-to-prison pipeline is real, zero tolerance policies, those kinds of things have all these medicines and things like that they try to put our children on. All these things have an influence, even if our children aren't directly affected. It has an influence on the type of education that they receive. And then when they get to be to the college level, I think especially in your freshman year, that's really their first experience of being not under mom and dad's thumb. But there's also that accountability and that push from mom and dad to take care of homework, to, you know, not drink so much on the weekends, to, you know, to try to find a part-time job, those kind of things that a mom and dad would have influence on that when you get to the college age, especially if you're away from home, all of that responsibility falls on you. So how much do you think the public school system, what could they be doing differently to prepare our boys for what they'll face, not only in if they choose to go to college, but in life overall?
I mean, they, you know, when we talk about what could they be doing, they could be doing a host of things to prepare them for the life of ahead. But the truth of the matter is that so many of their parents don't know what to do with their lives. You know, we're talking about people who have a desperate need for what could best be termed life coaching. And without that infusion of life coaches, they're as unanchored and as listless and directionless as their children are. You know, their children are a reflection of them. You know, today's school system is not, it should be, but let's face facts, it is usually not aimed at developing them and preparing them for life beyond. That's just where it is. Those are the realities. But in saying that, we have to recognize that, and then we have to go ahead as a community, and this goes back to the population that I was just recently referring to, population that I consider myself to be a part of. We have to go ahead and really, really, really take that seriously and supplement the things that are not being taught. We need to go back almost as an army within our community and go ahead and meet that need. And we do have some organizations. Like I spoke about the 100 Black Men. I was dealing with the 100 Collegiate. I know that that's a cadre of brothers who are actually doing that very thing that we're talking about. So there are some of us who are doing it. But, you know, I think that we need to not get ourselves into a mental state where we're not thinking that any of us are doing anything, and then we spiral mm-hmm. down even further into almost a unrequited depression, as if there is no hope whatsoever. The truth of the matter is that there are some of us who are doing things, and yet at the exact same time, we're still having these institutional barriers that are still erected against our people, and our people have to learn how to deal with them and to work their way around them. Even if working their way around them, the most efficient way to go around it is not to engage it at all and to pursue entrepreneurial opportunities. And I yield with that one.
Ashe. So, Dr. Jones, we also at one point had, you know, rites of passage programs that were more prevalent in our community. And I think that in going through those rites of passage, even if to a certain extent our young people experienced Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, they still had some sort of, I guess, I don't know, way to be influenced in a positive manner, even though Boy Scouts has turned into this organization who is now accepting homosexuals as troop leaders, which I seriously have a problem with. But, you know, at least we had something. So in that, it caused us to, I think, have a higher level of consciousness and self-responsibility. We cared a little bit more about our image, and I'm not just speaking about, you know, how we dress, but the impression that we left, especially on our elders, where it seems as though it had a certain amount of purpose to it, those things influencing our lives, whereas now those images and things like that are the opposite of what we see. So as far as image and purpose, what is the message to our young men to help them realize that, that is also a very important part of who they are, to want to have not only an outside appearance that, you know, everything's cool, I'm making money or whatever it is, you know, that appears to be on the outside, but on the inside too, so that they realize that it's not just about that, that their life also has to have a certain amount of purpose to it.
I mean, it comes through what I would term exposure and mentorship. These young men, I've found in my travels that many of these young men are starving for direction. You know, regardless of how much bravado, how much quote-unquote toughness that they have around them, they are often eggshell thick. You know, they're always on edge of having that shell kind of cracked. It comes through exposure. It comes through being around a man, and there is no shortcut to that. You know, if you're not around men, you know, what do you really expect? That they're, you know, even a dog needs to be around other dogs to understand that he's a dog. You learn those things by exposure, and it's one of the reasons why, the historically speaking, and now that I think about it, I think that the importance is even more significant than we really comprehend. The barbershop. That it's important for young boys to be at the barbershop, in many ways, to sit down in the barbershop and to learn how to handle their business, learn how to talk to the barber, learn how, you know, listen to some of the things that are said, and many of them are hilarious and comical, but there's some life lessons to be learned there. And when you really think about it, this whole idea, this movement to make attendance at the barbershop more convenient, meaning getting an appointment, is in many ways going ahead and robbing young boys of what is in many ways a rites of passage for Black America. They're no longer sitting in the barbershop and absorbing knowledge. They're coming in and they're getting a haircut and then leaving immediately, and really missing out on many of the most important things that they can learn, many of the jewels that they could possibly learn at that place. And I yield with that, Queen.
I say, Dr. Jones, I know I always talk about being a daddy's girl, and I didn't realize how much influence being in the barbershop with my dad had on me at that time, until I got a little bit older and realized that I always had closer relationships with men than I had with females, and I just wonder if that had a lot to do with it. Another thing is that I just wonder why my dad took me to the barbershop and not my brothers, because any time my dad moved, like if he was going anywhere, I went, including the barbershop. And I know that there were conversations being had there that I probably shouldn't have been privy to, but you're definitely right. I mean, even as a female, I can say that I learned a lot just by hanging out with my daddy, especially when it came to going to the barbershop with him.
Yeah, I mean, come on, let's be honest. You know, Black men are not monster men. The majority of them are not. The vast majority are not monster men. And there's something within us that causes us to, in every way, love our daughters. We raise our sons and we love our daughters, you know, and if we can say that about Black women, and they definitely raise their daughters and love their sons, you know, that's the yin and the yang of it. That's the reciprocity, the balance that we can get as a union, as a husband and wife, a man and a woman. There's something special, even energy wise, in having your daughter with you. You know, and, you know, most wise men are going to realize very early that, and, you know, and we live lives as men, and we come across women who have had these very disjointed, if non-existent, relationships their fathers. And it puts you in a mindset, no, I'm not going to have that for my daughter. And it causes you to, in many ways, seek to socialize your daughter in a way of how men are. And there's quite possibly no greater exposure than to have her beside you, where you can provide protection and she can also glean and observe and learn. I can, you know, I can tell you as an individual who has been bequeathed two daughters by marriage, that it is different. You look at the world different. Mm-hmm. It causes you to speak different and to consider some things differently, you know. And it's what it is. The sons, I can guarantee you that the sons probably think that I'm Attila the Hun sometimes. Whereas the daughters look at me like I'm the greatest thing walking on this earth. You know, I don't allow them to touch garbage. You know, and you can imagine how that goes over. You know, how come they can't pick something up? You know, and I don't even respond.
Lord.
You know, because I want them to understand what the standard is. And the standard of how a man treats you is this. And so it is what it is. You know, so, but I think that it's critical for black girls to understand that black men are human, that we have the same human frailties, we have the same insecurities, the same thoughts as any other man, okay? And that's a very, very beautiful thing for you to be able to say now that you were always with your father, you know, raised by your mother and loved by your father, you know, and that's the way it should be.
I don't know if you've also seen, along with the video that I posted on Manhood Raising Culture, and please, if you haven't seen the video, please go to Manhood Raising Culture, the group page, and it's posted there, the video that we're referencing. But there's also the video of the Muslim brother who broke up the fight between two young men and has gained a wide amount of notoriety because of his action, because of the fact that he intervened. So I want to know what you would say to the young men who were acting a fool on campus, and two, do you think that you would have done what the Muslim brother did and stopped the fight?
I didn't get the second part of what you said about him stopping the fight.
Do you think that you would have intervened and stopped these two young men from fighting?
You know, let me deal with the first part, which was, do I – repeat the first part again. I might be suffering Alzheimer's.
what do you think about the fight, and what do you think could have been done to prevent the bigger fight at the campus? And two, would you have intervened in the fight, you know, like the Muslim brother did, who broke up the young men and told them why, that they shouldn't be fighting one another? What can we do about both of those scenarios?
Okay, the first scenario was, and I'll say this from the end, we're talking about the Alcorn State Mess Hall fight. That's a fight that we could argue was in the making for probably 20 years. Those young men look like they were about 20 years old. That's behavior that is sown into them from a socialization level, where they're just going to, that's the way that they understand men behave. And that's how you act tough. That's how you quote unquote represent and what have you. What could have been done to prevent that? They could have been socialized differently. What could prevent that incident? I would argue probably nothing, because that type of behavior, you're talking about a level of rambunctiousness and an absence of wisdom that is hard to address on a moment-by-moment basis. The second one that you're talking about, would I have intervened? you know what? I don't know. And that's a very disappointing. I'm disappointed in myself in saying that I don't know. And one of the reasons why I'm so uncertain is that I've lived long enough, and I now recognize that so many of our children operate from a position where, and you saw it in that video, I would argue, where they don't have, they have neither the skills nor the logic to make very good decisions. And there is an element of disrespect that comes from our children. And in saying that, I've learned this through experience that it's very difficult to discipline individuals that you don't have a pre-existing relationship with. And so you really, in this day and time, not that you need to be scared, but you need to be very cautious in who you're dealing with. Because when you're dealing with individuals who have been raised in homes where they've been told that they're nothing but niggas, they haven't had a suitable African-American male figure in their lives, there's a depth of uncaring, of lack of discipline, of absence of logic and understanding that will put you in harm's way, really will. And I think that if we stop fronting and we have honest conversations about these types of matters, most people will tell you that they have come across African-American males who could fit the persona often of almost serial killers, to be honest with you, because they operate as if they have no conscience, as if they have no care. What they're out for is to get you to fear them. And they'll do anything because that's the epitome of what they consider to be respect. And I yield with that, Queenie.
Ashe, Dr. Jones, Ashe. We're going to take our break a little bit early tonight. We're almost at the top of the hour. You're listening to Sign of the Times, brought to you by New Car Radio Network. My name is Queen Tahira. We're here tonight with my co-host, Dr. James Jones of Manhood Racing Culture. Hang out with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, my beautiful people. This is Andreanne, and I'm host of the show Holistic Health and Healing on the New Power Radio Network. We all know that without your health, nothing else is worthwhile, right? I mean, what's the point of being rich if you end up spending all the time you have left and all the money you've made on the way to get back the health that was neglected on the journey? Well, let's get back to making our health and well-being a priority. Then the wealth and prosperity will automatically flow. So join us as we dive into all matters of health and well-being holistically in all areas of your life. We'll discuss the causes and effects of diseases and medical conditions and what you can do to heal from these effects. You'll hear suggestions on how to best utilize the medical establishment for your benefit instead of their profit. We'll explore all of the latest innovations in health and well-being and how to apply them in all areas of your life. In the end, we must remove everything that's creating and maintaining the pain and disease in our lives in order to treat our wounds and to heal. Here's to your holistic health. Many blessings. Peace.
Hello, I'm Dr. James Thomas Jones III, and I've just recently completed a manuscript titled Creating Revolution as They Advance, a Historical Narrative of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. This work traces the demise of the nonviolent civil disobedience of the civil rights movement and the rise of both the Black Power era and Black Panther Party. Special attention is paid to Panther leaders such as Huey P. Newton, Bobby Seale, Fred Hampton, Eldridge Cleaver, Bunchy Carter, and Geronimo Pratt. This story is told through the view of the Panthers and details the horrific underhanded attacks that the organization experienced at the hands of the FBI's counterintelligence program under the orders of J. Edgar Hoover. If you're looking for the true story of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, pick up a copy of Creating Revolution as They Advance, a historical narrative of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense on Amazon.com. Thank you.
Baby, let me explain to you what I'm saying.
What you saying?
It's not even like that.
It wasn't like that, but I saw you.
Baby, I don't love her.
You don't love me? You know what? I don't even want
to
talk.
She don't mean nothing to me.
I don't
want
to see your face.
She was just telling me.
I just want to see you walking through that
baby,
door. Baby, ain't nothing else to
why
say.
Why we gotta do it like this? Baby.
Damn.
Come home late. It seems you barely beat the sun. Tapping my shoulder. Thinking you gon' get you some. Smelling like some fragrance that I don't even wear. So if you want some loving, I suggest you go back there. Where you came from? Day to day with you, it's always something else. Working my nerve. God knows that I don't deserve what you put me through. Cause I've been so true to you. For you to come at me with another lame excuse. See, I
welcome back to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by New Power Radio Network and the UAC. Welcome back, Dr. Jones.
All right, ma'am. I'm here.
Ashe. Okay, so can you go ahead and reintroduce tonight's topic? And I want to remind the listeners, if you're listening on your phone, you can push 1 and come into queue and be a part of the conversation. If you're listening on your computer, you can dial in at 917-889-8059, 917-889-8059, and again, please don't forget to push 1 so we can bring you into the conversation. I yield to you, Dr. Jones.
Right, the conversation we were dealing with today was spurred by a video of a fight in the mess hall at Alcorn State University, and what we've been talking about tonight is the idea, do the streets have more influence upon African American males today, than on African American collegians, than even the great intellectuals that have been in our tradition for so very long, Du Bois, Hughes, Baldwin, and the list can go on and on and on. Basically, what today does it mean to be an African American man within our community? And I yield with that, Queen.
So, Dr. Jones, another one of the things that we talked about so far is the difference in what manhood is. How do you think that the influence of Europeans have had to do with how our young men are being raised? We know that the majority of the teachers in the public school system are usually white females. So what can we do about that, and how much influence do you think that that has had on how we're seeing our young men and how they're turning out today?
I mean, what we can do about it is actually raise up a cadre of African-American educators to, you know, man independent Black institutions, if not public schools that they are, as they are right now, and have to deal with the, while you're dealing with that curriculum, hopefully you'll be able to do some good and mentor some students in the same process. However, the idea of Europeans having so much influence upon the development and construction of what manhood is nothing new. I mean, you have to remember, if we go back and we look at that post-slavery period, Reconstruction, one of the greatest complaints that landowning whites who had Black folks sharecropping on their land, one of their greatest and most significant complaints was quite simply that African-American men would not allow their wives to be out in the field often working. therefore curtailing the bottom line profits that these white men were going to recoup, you know, off of that land. And many, you know, we have many testimonies of these black sharecroppers who say that, why would I have my wife out there working when the white man's wife doesn't go out there? She doesn't work in the field, so why should mine? So in many ways, when we're talking about patriarchal society, oftentimes the baseline understanding of what a man is a replication of what white folk have presented as far as manhood and what have you. It's one of the reasons why you have so many African-American males who do not recognize black women as being their equal, as being their, you know, their partner in these endeavors. We look at it from the position of the Europeans, and that position is quite simply that the man is the head, is the totalitarian, is the tyrant, is the dominant one within the family. And that's kind of foreign to the way that persons of African descent have lived historically. And, you know, I'll say this in final, the problem with African-American men also replicating the idea and patterning themselves after the models that white men have presented is that African-American men are definitely not capable of providing for themselves and providing for their families. They're going as beggars to the white man for employment opportunities, and therefore are not always able to assume that position as the sole provider for their family. And I yield with that.
Ashe, I'm going to go ahead and open up Sister Andreanne. Peace, sis. Welcome to Sign of the Times. I know you're traveling. How you doing? Welcome.
I'm sorry. I welcome. I mean, thank you. I am going to apologize ahead of time because I am in the airport, but I'm listening to the conversation. TSA turned my phone off. but I, you know what struck me as I was going through security was the barbershop. And I'm like, yeah, we need to just like build up the barbershop on many levels, like a place to not only come together. I had a great experience when my hair was shaved. I just went to the barbershop. I went to the brother in the, you know, the barbershop and sat there. And being in a family of all girls, I didn't get a chance to experience it as you did, Queen. So me as a grown woman sitting there, and I'm like, wow, this is something else. This is great. I mean, the camaraderie, the bonding, all of that, you know. And again, even as a grown woman, I was probably not privy to some of the stuff they were saying. But nonetheless, you know, when they would look at me and kind of almost ask if it was okay, I'm like, you know what, this is your world. Speak your truth. And I would just sit back and take it in. And it wasn't even about, you know, just making an appointment. I would just fly in from a trip and just head to my barbershop and just listen in and where to see where their head was at, you know. And it was just that spot where you had – because of what it is, getting your hair cut, you really, you know, just like we would at a spa or anything, you know, kind of relaxing like that, you get a chance to just sit and think and ponder different points, you know, in your world, you know, in your society as you see it. And, you know, it's kind of like maybe we need to be have like that barbershop renaissance, you know, even if they're all about making the appointment, you know, just have that as the local, you know, kind of safe place, safe haven, you know, because a lot of young men are missing out on that experience if they're raised by women, because they'll go, you know, the women is just thinking get in and get out, you know, they're not seeing it as its own experience, you know, it becomes a chore to the woman, I imagine, because I don't have that direct experience. My nephew, we cut his hair at home when we could. So, but I imagine that, you know, in her harried week of all of the things that she has to do and getting her son's hair cut among them, that just becomes almost its own chore. So it'd be nice to just kind of get that barbershop renaissance where we can just come together and even build business, you know, and think of ways of just stepping out of that that pattern of going to the man to find a job, you know, because we have all of these great minds that come together and, you know, philosophy just spitting, you know, knowledge all throughout that whole space, you know. So I just am loving the conversation, and that point just kind of excited me because I was like, yes, yes, you know. And then hearing you, Queen, reflect on your experience in a barbershop, it's such a dynamic place, even as simple as it is. It really is one of those anchors, you know. It's like the candy lady, you know, in the neighborhood, you got the barbershop, you know. So with that, I yield, and I thank you guys. I'm going to mute myself just because of the noise in the background. Thank you.
Thank you, Sister Adrienne. I yield to you, Dr. Jones.
You know, I think that it may very well be time for us to go ahead and start a movement to work against the idea of having an appointment within the barbershop. You know, I think that we live these lives where we're so busy, and, you know, we're missing out in our busyness upon what the best return to intellectually life-sustaining water and socialization for young African-American men and African-American men in general. You know, there needs to be a convening of the council. We need to be around each other a little bit more than we are, because right now what we have are these fleeting, anonymous relationships that in many ways contribute to and make our residents within what could best be termed a disassembled community to be normal and standard in the expectation of just that's just how life is. So maybe we need to start a movement of no more appointments, that on Saturdays you will spend 3-4 hours in the barbershop sitting there talking junk, talking about everything and nothing, and saving black men at the exact same time. And I yield with that.
Ashe, I do believe that Ice Cube had the right type of imagery in mind when he developed the movie's barbershop. The politics of the movies, you know, we could get into, but that's one thing that I can say rang true in seeing those movies, is that that is definitely the type of atmosphere that I remember. But I also, you know, went to the beauty salon with my mom, and it was the same type of atmosphere there, except for it was coming from us as women, girls, and sisters in the same type of environment. And, you know, we could get into the beauty shop talk just like the brothers in the barbershop would get into their talk. So I guess maybe the sense of community is what we're missing, more so than the actual physical place of it being a barbershop or a beauty salon, because we also had those same type of relationships in the church atmosphere and to a certain extent with after-school programs and sports teams we may have been involved in. There are all kinds of ways to develop alternative and outside relationships other than the relationships that we have with our parents and in our family. So how else can we get creative with, one, instilling in our young men how important it is for them to step up to the table and be men? And, two, what advice do we give our sisters who are out here, who are young, and what we see in the media is the same thing that they see. So how can they, you know, be schooled a little bit and making the right types of choices in the brothers that are out here? And I yield.
You know, the thing is that when you're talking about showing African-American men the need for them to be men, It's almost comical that you would need to show people that, but evidence is proving to us that it's something that definitely needs to be taught. It needs to be instructed and what have you. How do we do it? I'm just a stickler for the idea of exposure. You know, we have to have them around us. We have to have them listening to what it is that really matters, to understand that your fuel has got to be the taking care of your family, to make sure that they're all right, that's the acknowledgement that you're receiving, you know, that you're doing a good job as a man, that things are being taken care of. I think that those lessons, though, and ironically, I was speaking about this earlier, when one of the eighth graders that I spoke about speaking with earlier today, one of the Collegiate 100, asked me who were my role models growing up, and I told him my father. You know, now don't think that my father was a very affectionate man, but I saw the standard base of getting up every day and going to work and providing for your family and being present in the home and present in your children's lives. Those are developmental issues. Those are things that you need to see growing up. And I think that there needs to be a moratorium placed upon sisters getting with brothers who are not marriageable, and also brothers getting with sisters who are not really understanding what the dynamics are within a family as far as a relationship. Because quite simply, as we talk about, there are a lot of African-American men who have not had fathers and have not been mentored in that way. Let us also be very honest and very consistent and logical in our thinking and say quite simply that we got a lot of daddyless little girls who have absolutely positively no idea what a woman's role is within a marriage. You do not inherit that or get that solely because you're a female. You know, that's as logical as saying that you learn how that you're instantaneously a man because you got a penis. You know, so it goes both ways. And just as you attested to, Queen, the fact that a lot of your socialization occurred around your father. You learned how a man treats a woman. You heard those stories of how women reacted to men treating women that way. It goes both ways. The absence of either parent is in many ways going to be devastating to a child if that is not met by some other force. And I yield with that.
Ashe.
Yes, I'd like to join in on that one, you know, because we were talking about, Jay and I were talking about how, you know, it's really quick for us in this day and age to say, you know, men need to man up, our men need to man up. But it's very true, you know, we have lost our sense of what our role is in the family. We know maternal instincts don't just appear just because you're pregnant, let alone the whole course of what a mother needs to be to their child. And then that role becomes even more complicated when it's a single mother having to navigate that path, you know. So, but I think it is important for us sisters to understand that whatever we are, you know, we kind of have to hang up our capes and yield to our community in a barbershop setting. You know, we can sit with our sons and kind of pick out, see where our sons gravitate in that conversation. Where does his attention go? And, you know, find that mentor or someone that he at least listens to and looks up to or gravitates towards, you know, and giving that strong word. And not be afraid actually to direct them, to show them that this is someone you should aspire to. And some of even those, I've been in scenarios even in the barbershop where you'll have a young brother come in and he's all gangstered out, and the conversation actually will come down. It will, the fierceness of the energy will come down. You know, it's almost like somebody was afraid to speak their truth because this, you know, this young gangster wannabe has, you know, kind of got his butt on his shoulders walking in the barbershop. We can't be afraid to approach our youth. I mean, there was a time where it didn't matter how old you were, your neighbor down the street, you know, or big mama, whoever it is, can reach up and kind of pop you upside the head and grab your ear and say, you know, toe the line, tighten it up. So we, you know, in that, as we stand as a mentoring position, we can't be afraid to even approach our young people and letting them know when they are, you know, out of order and out of line and not pulling their weight, male and female. You know, our sisters, you know, I help a lot of sisters get English jobs, English positions, and it's amazing to me how they've kind of, you know, and they can be into their 30s and not able to really navigate, in outside of their communities and going forth to just get a simple position that will, you know, feed their family. And, you know, just to bring it all home, we just need to, you know, make sure that we are available. I think that Dr. Jones touched on it earlier, that we are out there. We just have to make sure we're accessible and that we can always, you know, say, wave our hand. What do you need? You know, reach out. What do you need? And because they don't always know. They don't know what they don't know, you know. So sometimes we have to kind of pull their coattails and say, you know what, you're not sure how to navigate this. You want me to help you, you know, and make it a better situation for you? Okay, here we go. And with that, I yield.
You know, one of the things that happened today, I was approached by one of the eighth graders who, you know, you can pick out that one with the gold chain that was, you know,
yep.
You're like, okay, that's the one right there, that, you
uh-huh.
know, the alpha male, you know.
Yep.
You know,
that's
and
exactly it.
Yeah, and after I finished speaking, I was making my way, you know, up, they were getting ready to take pictures, and he approaches me, and he shakes my hand, and he says, thank you so much for, you know, taking your time out, you know, to come in and speak with us. Can I, you know, get some information from you? Can I get a business card? I said, you know what, I don't have a business card with me, but my site, you can get everything that you need to contact me is right there. And he said, I'll definitely be contacting you. And he says that, you know, because I asked him, I said, what's your 5-year plan? And he tells me, he says, you know, I'd never thought about a 5-year plan. He said, but what I'll say is that in 5 years from now, I'll be sitting in your history class. And I'm like, okay, all right, well, you know, that's a start. You know, so, you know, we prove ourselves to be accessible, you know, to them. But they also have to, you know, come some way and let us know that they're not only in need of what we can offer them, but they also are respecting it and desiring it. And I yield with that as well.
Right on, right on.
Yeah. You know, our young men, they have it hard, a lot harder than they did in previous generations, because I think they do have to prove themselves in a different way. Whether they're even the ones that are somewhat effeminate, they still have a certain amount of aggression in them, to where, you know, they want to prove their individuality, they want to prove their manhood, they want to prove that they're tough, you know, that kind of thing, and it has taken on more so of a violent and physical form. Than more so now than ever. I mean, we see it with all the killings that are happening in Chicago and other cities. And what I can't quite figure out is that we have a tendency to quite easy to fight one another, male, female, whatever, couples, even whatever. We find it a lot easier to fight one another and to the tooth than it is to for us to stand up and speak truth to power to our oppressors. And I need some help figuring that out. I don't know quite why that is, that we, you know, is it solely because those are the people who are closest to us, or is it easier to attack someone that you know cares about you? And I yield.
I don't think it's many things, but it is because that's the person close to you. But we know that our oppressor will come down hard on us. We still have that master oppressive air that we think we need to contend with, and a lot of it is in the form of our police in our neighborhood. You know, a lot of the reasons why, you know, when you ask someone about a Black Wall Street, the first thing they'll give you, yeah, how do we keep it? You know, we there are, you know, entrepreneurs out there, but how do we protect it? You know, so we think that it's almost our own dead end to come up with those type of solutions, because we don't know, you know, how to protect it. Part of that filters down into the family. A lot of the frustration, I imagine, of the Black man, from what I've gathered talking with my friends, colleagues, and loved ones, is that they do feel frustrated and that they can't protect the family that they do have. You know, they can't be sure as sure as their other colored counterparts out there, that what they do won't come under some scrutiny or discrimination, oppression in some form. And that creates frustration. And who do you lash out in that type of scenario? You're going to lash out with those around you. You're not going to lash out at your oppressor. You know, it takes a lot. You have, it's almost a change in mental paradigm. And it's part of the remnants of the Willie Lynch, that we won't lash out at our oppressor. We lash out and express our frustration like those boys, you know, cutting up at Alcorn. That's not frustration against each other. That's frustration against the system. Where do they go with that, though? You know, it's just like our riots in our inner cities, our riots in Watts. We don't go and tear up our oppressor's property. We tear up our own. And we're almost unique with that in the United States. There are other cultures that do that, but those cultures have been oppressed, strongly oppressed, not as much and not as long in this modern day, but oppressed. Those are the ones, you know, you see that person who has been tortured or under such mental stress, what do? They beat themselves upside the head or knock their own head up against the wall. They don't lash out at their oppressor. That's part of our mental illness, that it does take almost its own leap in paradigm to get over. With that, I yield.
You know, I've found that so many of our quote-unquote tough guys, they cower in the presence of white folk, you know, or they'll behave in a way that makes them so outlandish and so outrageous that they can't be taken seriously. And, you know, it really boils down to this harsh reality that the world, that the ways that white folk are able to control the world and control us, especially domestically, have very little to do with any sort of physicality, unless the police are involved, the military is involved. But on a day-to-day, man-to-man situation, it has nothing to do with physicality. It has everything to do with intelligence, intellect, the mental side of things. And our people are usually not equipped to deal with that. We don't possess those skills, to be quite honest with you. The average brother does not know what to say in a parent-teacher conference, does not know what to say to a loan officer, does not know what to say to a politician. And it's that moment of ineptitude, which comes off as rank cowardice, that in many ways seals our fate and guarantees that their rule over us in that instance will continue uninterrupted. So it's one of those of they need to develop those skills, what the Panthers refer to as bourgeoisie skills, but they've been taught that manhood is almost totally about a physical nature, about a physical attack, about you being bigger and badder. So when they come across someone that is neither bigger nor badder from their perspective, yet he still rules. You know, he almost takes the position of a god, and that lends to their cowering away and their inability to do any sort of fighting, any sort of debate on those grounds that are not a fist fight or a street fight. And they know if they do get physical with them, they are going not to jail but to the penitentiary, and I yield with that.
Thank you both for your responses to that. So in looking at the fact that this fight, this melee, happened at an institution of higher learning, it seems as though there's not a lot of respect for not only the institution but what it represents, and the fact that, you know, it's not easy paying college tuition and that kind of thing unless you have well-to-do parents. You know, a lot of these students are on loan and things like that, and it's hard to get through college and pay that kind of stuff back. So are we looking at alternatives to the collegiate higher education. And if so, even though a lot of our young men are past high school age, I do believe that we can still have some influence on them. So what should we be trying to, I guess, instill in them, even though technically they may be, quote unquote, grown?
I think that we need to instill upon them and impress upon them and reach them via a discussion, a very serious discussion surrounding how do you, number one, maintain your freedom and your sanity and your in a moral base, develop a moral base, a moral compass, however you want to term it, and make your way towards money. And the only way efficiently for African Americans to do that, realistically for them to do that, is entrepreneurship. We need to look at our surroundings and we need to figure out what is it that we spend our money on. And then we need to go through a process, as long and tedious as it may be, we need to go through that process and we need to figure out how we can plug ourselves into that chain. And we need to educate within our community the idea of circulating your dollar amongst your own. Failure to do that means that we are doomed. It's that simple. There's nothing too tricky about it. It's about entrepreneurship. It's about circulating your dollar. And any business that you see that is not owned by one of us is create a competing one and outdo them with your service and with your product. And hopefully our people are not crazy enough to believe that the white man's ice, the Asian man's ice, is colder than your ice. And I yield with that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree totally.
Come on, Adrian. You can't just say you agree and that's it. What else? Is that it?
Well, in a nutshell, it is. But yeah, don't get caught up in believing that, you know, their product is going to be better, because that is an issue that we deal with. You know, we will take their service over what's provided by our service. Our, you know, you got people that adamantly say, oh, I ain't going to deal with, you know, I can't deal with black folks. You know, they show up late, they don't complete, they do this. You know, we have our own stereotypes about doing business with each other, you know. And so, yeah, we have to open up that dialogue and you know, push that forward, you know, and that's part of pulling those businesses into the community, into the dialogue, into the barbershop, even if it's not in the barbershop per se, but it can be just a community group called the barbershop, whatever it is, but just with those intentions in mind, you know, pulling in all of it, because we have a lot of talent. We have a lot of raw talent. You know, you got a lot of brothers just work with their hands, you know, on the roofs, building. They can build a house if given the opportunity, you know. So we have all of these talents out there, be it online, offline, on the ground, you know, pulling those together, inviting them into that arena, the barbershop arena, whatever it is, and say, hey, you know, we have a whole community here for you. You know, don't get discouraged. We're trying to regroup. Let's, you know, build it and help you build your business. And how about this? Why don't you take on a young brother or a young sister and mentor? You know?
That's right. That's right. Even though, you know, we need to be clear on the meaning of the word mentor, it's my understanding it has some evil roots. But, yeah, I mean, to have that example of what manhood, what womanhood is really the only way. And to have stronger communal ties, I think also will help us, I guess, find our own solution to our own problems, because we definitely know that the outside society, other than those, you know, those that don't look like us, cannot problem solve for us. This is something that we are definitely going to have to do for ourselves. So, Dr. Jones, I know that tonight's your night to be on the air with Brother Muhammad. Next week, Sister Adrienne has said that she's willing to co-host with you, because I'm going to be at a function. And so can you two maybe bounce around a couple ideas on what we can do for next week?
Yay!
I'll yield to the sister. Let's see what you got, sis. I want to hear.
You know what? I don't have anything. Actually, I would like to get back on your male-female relations. You know, we kind of missed out on that. But you always come up with such good content. You come up with such good content in your blogs. But let's just come back around to that and kind of really hone in on it. And we can just even extrapolate from this conversation today. You know, how do we work with each other?
All right. Well, there it is right there.
Well, that sounds good to me. Dr. Jones, what's the number to call in on Brother Muhammad's station? Blog Talk.
Give me 1 second, because I'm one of those that don't know numbers. I just, I hit a button. And and so as a result of that, if I lose my phone, I can't call nobody. Okay, the number for who did it to you is 563-999-3682. We start at, what would it be, 8 o'clock Eastern?
Yes.
Yeah, 8 o'clock Eastern.
So
and it's always interesting when I'm with the nation.
I bet. You said 563-999.
Let me close it up. 3682.
3682. Okay, 563-999-3682. Do you all have a subject matter for tonight?
No. It usually turns into callers and questions, and it's always fun. He's using the Google Plus audience and what have you. And it usually turns into a bit of banter back and forth. Last week we wound up talking about the idea of Pan-Africanism. And we have, I don't know if you've ever met Brother Pianki, a ultra-conservative brother, but he made an appearance and really disturbed everybody's spirit in Black America. So it's always... always very interesting. Brother Muhammad, he can get worked up and get to screaming and hollering at folk. And so if nothing else, it is extremely entertaining. I have moments when I'm silent because I have to mute my phone because I'm over here cracking up at something that one of them has said. So everybody is welcome, and just come on over there.
All right. Well, I'm gonna give you a break between time. Meantime, so 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682 is the number. Title of the broadcast is Who Did It to You?
I think that might be. Is it 3682?
That's what I wrote down. Wait a minute.
Yes, yeah, 3682. You're correct. You're correct. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. Okay, so thank you, Sister Andrian, for being willing to fill in for Sister next week. I appreciate it. She's going to learn how to run the board and everything, Dr. Jones. So.
No,
I couldn't do it without you. All right, y'all. All right, well, thank you, everybody, for tonight's conversation, and we're looking forward to doing some more exciting things in the future. I ask that you please send me and my family as much positive energy as you possibly can. My granddaughter turns 2 next week on the 20th, so the next week's going to be full of balloons and happiness, and so I'd love to be able to share that with you. So send me as much positive energy as you can, and I'll do the same with you. And so thank you, Sister Andrian. Thank you, Dr. Jones. We appreciate you, and we'll see you on the other side tomorrow night at 6 p.m. here on Sign of the Times. Thank you, everybody.
Love.
We'll see you soon.
All right. Love you.
All right.
Bless you. Niggas be in the crack of courtrooms. Don't be understand what the fuck they do. I understand everything the motherfuckers be saying. They be coming in that bitch like, you're wrong, my lawyer. As you see, my client comes from a broken home. Being solely raised by a grandmother who works 2 jobs, even on the weekends. If we systematically allow the courts to adjudicate this young man, we won't be a part of the solution. In fact, we'll play a major role in the forever-going problems that increasingly plagues urban America. And then the state say, objection, Your Honor. To let this menace back into our society would be a great mistake. Let the records reflect that Mr. Thompson scores out to life without any possible chance of parole. Therefore, it's imperative that the courts focus on the defendant's criminal history instead of its ethical background. And then the judge say, Mr. Thompson, you got anything to say? Yep, growing up without a father in my motherfucking household, I had to be a man a long time ago, introduced to the game at a young age, while my peers all hung out at the arcade. The reason why I never talked about my problems, because you had your own and still haven't solved them. You labeled me as a kid who couldn't cope with life, but you could never understand unless you're poor and black. First day of school was like the last day. While you was playing volleyball, I was searching for that fast pace. My granny's holding down a job or two. We had to make ends meet, so I got mine off the avenue. Cash flows through the inner city streets, and I thank the Lord for giving me survival instincts. Many of night, I came across somebody's child, leaving this world, gangland style. And all the while, my mind was taking mental notes. Another Negro, ghetto hero, murder she wrote. Could have been me 6 feet deep, but I'm still around on ghetto ground. Shit go down pound for pound. I'm slinging bricks at the chain gang, and I'ma sling the motherfuckers harder until some things change. So if my past reflects on my destination, then you know I'm in a fucked up situation. And if I'm wrong from getting it the best I can, Your Honor, I'm guilty of being a man. And then the judge go to saying some shit like this here. Before I release the jury of your peers for deliberation, Mr. Thompson, I would like you to further elaborate on your upbringing. What caused such a young man of your caliber to commit such heinous crimes since the age of 9? Well, 7 kids and 7 different fucking daddies. I used to wish my mammy would have never had me. As I recall, the AFDC we received wasn't enough, and all of us had to eat. I showed no love for whoever tried to knock the hustle, and feel the same if you never really had the struggle. You motherfuckers always place the blame on my kind. When we retaliate, y'all quick to say we've lost our minds and give us time. When time is all we got, maybe I need 3 free hots in that goddamn clock. Cause if I die in the street or in the pen, leaving my kin with no cheese will be my only sin. I pray to God that you crack the finally understand I'm only guilty of being a motherfucking man. And then the jury come in that bitch and they be like, the jury has reached its verdict. Count 1, traffic of cocaine, we find an defendant guilty. Count 2, battered on a law enforcement officer, we find the defendant guilty. Count 3, resisting arrest with violence, we also find the defendant guilty. But due to the insinuating circumstances that surround the case, Your Honor, we, the ladies and gentlemen of the jury, are only forced to find the defendant guilty simply of being a man due to the unusual circumstances. Recess, mistrial.